From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. A Chicago bankruptcy court this week gave United Airlines the go-ahead to default on its pension obligations. This is a big win for the troubled airline, but for the tens of thousands of people who work at United, it could mean significant benefit cuts. Companies in other industries may now seek similar concessions. Tonight on Point, pension meltdown, Americans' retirement plans at risk. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with a reaction and step-back analysis of today's news about base closings. Earlier today, the Pentagon proposed shutting down more than 150 military installations and 33 major bases. It would be the first round of base closures in a decade. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said the plan would save nearly $50 billion and make the military better suited to fight the global war on terrorism. Mark Mazzetti is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him about the biggest surprises on the list.
Some of the biggest surprises were that the Northeast took some big losses on this Pentagon closure list, most notably Connecticut, which lost about 8,000 military and civilian jobs or proposed losses, and that's significantly because the naval base, the submarine base in New London, Connecticut, the Pentagon wants to close and relocate those submarines further south. The other interesting thing, I think, is the general continued trend south and to some extent west of the military. The Pentagon is moving a lot of its installations out of the Northeast, which, as you know, in the Northeast, is much more confined areas where training is more difficult. There's less open space to the south and the west where there is more open space.
Well, there were 33 major closings, 775 smaller ones. Did every state take a hit?
Every state did take a hit, and that could be a very, very small installation that got closed to a very large installation that got closed. So there were across the board cuts. It is important to point out that it's a significantly smaller proposed list than we had been expecting for the last few years. Rumsfeld had said as recently as a few months ago that about 25% of the total base structure was in excess of what they really needed. And right now he's saying it's about 5 to 10%. So we were expecting a lot more bases to be closed and a lot more bigger and more significant bases to be closed than actually this list reflects.
Well, how is the Pentagon justifying these closings and staff reductions?
They're saying that the bases in the United States are not they're not aligned the way they should be. They're aligned based on a World War II and a Cold War era security environment. There's no need to have bases that are solely Air Force bases or Army bases or Navy bases. The real focus this time around was on consolidating bases where what the Pentagon calls jointness, where the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines all work together. So you'll see a lot more bases that are both joint Army and Air Force bases or Navy and Air Force bases. And in many ways does make sense. It reduces the Pentagon's overhead, and it also reduces the amount of money the Pentagon has to spend defending these bases. Fewer bases means, you know, fewer MPs and fewer troops to guard the bases.
Well, is that what Defense Secretary Rumsfeld is talking about when he says that this realignment is going to make the U.S. military more mobile, better able to fight the global war on terrorism?
It's all part of Rumsfeld's overall plan to make the military more mobile. And when they say mobile, it's being able to get to what they call strategic hotspots more quickly. So if you consolidate more men and equipment into certain hub bases, you're able to relocate them on a moment's notice by air or by sea to places they need to go. If they're stuck in the middle of the country sometimes, they are less likely to be able to get to those places when they need to get there. So it is part of this overall Rumsfeld vision of making the military leaner and making it more mobile.
But of course, as you know, base closings are a huge political hot potato in Congress. As you were able to look at the list, could you tell if Democratic and Republican districts were hit equally?
We have done our sort of impromptu red state, blue state analysis, and it looks like they were hit pretty equally. But there's some very interesting political stories on this list. Notably, the South Dakota Air Base, Ellsworth Air Force Base, was a political hot potato in the election last November between Senator John Thune, Congressman John Thune, and former Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle. The two both said that they needed to be elected because they were the only ones who was going to be able to keep the base open. And Thune, who is a Republican, was elected, and as it turns out, his ties to the White House did not allow him to keep his base.
He may have some explaining to do back home.
That's right. And the other big hit is in Mississippi politically, where Trent Lott, former Senate Majority Leader, had been petitioning to keep Pascagoula Naval Station open, and the Pentagon now wants to shut it down.
These are just recommendations, though. What happens next?
Well, these are recommendations to the BRAC Commission. BRAC is Base Realignment and Closure Commission.
Okay.
And this is appointed by President Bush. And these are, as you said, merely the Pentagon's recommendations to the commission, which then ultimately makes the decisions, the final decisions, about which bases should be closed, which should be realigned. And then their recommendations, which are due out in the fall, will go to Congress for approval.
Mark Mazzetti, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Mark Mazzetti is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. A court ruled Tuesday that United Airlines could default on its pension obligations. United's not the only airline in trouble, of course. U.S. Airways has already grounded its pension plan. Delta's may be headed for a rough landing, too. Beyond airlines, many auto parts manufacturers are stuck in Chapter 11. And Ford and GM's debt just got downgraded to junk status. The group supposed to protect worker pension plans, the Pension Guarantee Benefit Corporation, could soon run out of money itself. Tonight on Point, corporate pension plans in jeopardy, and what's at stake for Americans' retirement plans. And joining me now from Fairfield, Connecticut, with the latest on United's efforts to climb out of bankruptcy is Nanette Burns, senior writer for Business Week magazine. Welcome, Nanette.
Thank you.
Help us understand the process for this Chicago bankruptcy court. Why was United Airlines allowed to get off the hook in its pension obligations? Was that simply the best of a lot of really bad choices?
I think probably so. It took quite a while for them to come to this conclusion. United went into Chapter 11 in December of 2002. So it wasn't a decision made lightly. Pensions are an extraordinary expense for the airline because they were significantly underfunded for many years, and there's a big debt owed. And United was having a hard time getting any financing to get out of bankruptcy without a guarantee that that money would not immediately get sucked into the pensions.
And so what does this mean now for the company and for the workers?
Well, for the workers, it means probably a cut in pension benefits. I think the machinists have estimated that their members could lose 27% of what they're seeing. Pilots probably could lose a lot more, up to 70% of what they were promised. So it's a big cutback for them. There are 121,000 current and former employees of United covered by these plans. It's a lot of people impacted. Now, the airline believes that this will help them to continue to operate and continue to be an employer for these people. So they're hoping this will be the beginning of their exit from bankruptcy.
Well, but a 70% cut in your retirement, I mean, would that ever be made up if the company did become profitable at some point?
I don't think so, because once these plans are transferred to the government-owned pension insurer, the PBGC, they are there permanently, and they won't come back to United. So I think this is probably a permanent situation for these pilots. Pilots are a little bit of an exceptional situation because of FAA rules. They have to retire at 60, and the insurer penalizes them for retiring before 65, so they get an extra hard hit.
Can you give us a sense of what companies might be next?
I think a lot of people are worried about Delta, including Delta. they have a really big outstanding pension obligation, and at the end of this year, they have a bit of a relief from making their pension as much as they actually owe into the pensions, as big contributions as they actually owe, but that will expire at the end of this year, so they're going to really face a big ramp up in pension costs next year, and they're worried about that. Northwest is another airline with big underfunded pension problems, and as you mentioned in the introduction, introduction, also the auto parts suppliers are also of some concern to people.
Is there anything United could have done to have avoided being in this kind of mess?
Well, United has lost a lot of money for a long time. I think they've lost $4.5 billion since they went into bankruptcy. They have had a lot of structural problems. I think, you know, in hindsight, you could say maybe they promised too much to employees in terms of retirement, and also that they should have made it a higher priority if they could have to fund these promises as they were made.
Nanette Burns, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nanette Burns, senior writer for Business Week magazine. And Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst, how does all of this resonate in your brain?
Well, I'm just thinking about people like flight attendants for these airlines. They claim, their union claims, they may lose 75% of their benefits. And when you think that how poorly they're paid, the one consolation is that some of their pay is all these years had been going into their pensions. And they would have at least a tolerable pension, even if they didn't have a tolerable salary. And now all that seems to be in jeopardy. It's a tragic situation for these people.
We are talking this hour about corporate pension plans in jeopardy and also what's at stake for Americans' retirement plans. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you sign on to your company in part because of its generous pension plan? And do you worry now that your retirement might be in jeopardy, your financial security in peril? Whom do you trust when it comes to your retirement money? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the airline industry turning its back on retirees and also what that could mean for your retirement plans. We invite you to join the conversation. Can you imagine your company pension plan disappearing? Do you have a fallback plan? And are pension plans simply too big a burden for U.S. companies to bear? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to bring Richard Brownlee into the conversation now. He's joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He's a professor at the Darden School of Business Administration at the University of Virginia and an expert on corporate pension and employee stock ownership plans. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and welcome from Mr. Jefferson's University. It's nice to be back with you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, and always a pleasure to have Jack Beatty with us. He's joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, our On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Richard Brownlee, to you first. United offered its employees a defined benefit plan. What is that exactly? How many companies still have them? You know, how does all this work?
Well, these actually began really after the war, when companies were trying to entice employees to come to work for them and to keep them. That was back when employees thought they would work for a company for a long time, and companies were willing to essentially assume the risk of promising benefits to be paid upon retirement based on future salaries and length of service. And the companies assumed the risk of having the money, and it wasn't until some years later that the government stepped in with ERISA and sort of forced them to fund these plans. But that was the idea, and it was a good deal for employees, and companies thought that they would be able to pay for it. Times were good, and we had not yet seen the likes of the kind of competitive environment that we've seen in recent years. So it was just an idea that at its time made sense, and at this point in time makes a lot less sense.
Well, what a shock for people to have assumed that that was always going to be there, and all of a sudden a lot of people have to be reconsidering that.
That's probably an understatement. I think that's fair to say that the promises that were made and the legal contracts that were made, there was a trust between the companies and the employees that the employees never really ever thought that that trust and that contract would be broken. And the sad reality is, and it is a sad reality, that's what's happening now.
And what is the trend in terms of these defined benefit plans? Are companies still offering them, or are they, you know, a lot more leery about them?
They, for the last 15-plus years, have been moving away from the defined benefit plans and essentially replacing them by defined contribution plans like the 401k plans, where the employees essentially have responsibility for their own investments and the employees aren't promising to pay anything out in the future. And startup companies, and that's one of the issues. The startup airlines are not going with defined benefit plans. They're offering defined contribution plans. So they're avoiding the problem that the old line companies, airlines, autos, steel, what have you, got themselves into back at another era. And so we're seeing a massive shift in the kinds of pension plans that are being offered, and in fact, the kinds of plans that I think employees want. I've seen a dramatic shift in my graduate business school students over the last 10 years. They don't trust the companies to have the money, and they're more interested in defined contribution plans. So in a way, we're looking at a kind of pension plan that's a thing of the past.
Well, is it even possible for companies to be competitive today in a very different economic model and still offer the kind of benefits that we were looking at, or at least the kind of promises that were made, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I think it is, although I think probably most corporate executives would see that it's possible to not offer defined benefit plans and still attract and retain the kind of employees that they want. It's a different era, and I think the relationship with employees is different. And so I suspect that even though those organizations that happen to see long-term profitability, whatever long-term is anymore, are probably going to opt for defined contribution plans rather than for defined benefit plans. Nevertheless, there's still a lot of them. There's still a lot of them out there, and we're beginning to see what you might think is the perfect storm in the defined benefit pension arena. Lots of things coming together that are going to change the landscape dramatically. And unfortunately, the ultimate losers in this thing are going to be the employees who trusted their companies to make good on their promises.
Well, Jack Beatty, what about that? I mean, is betrayal too harsh a word here, or is that exactly what this is?
Betrayal, but by circumstances as much as anything, although I don't doubt that these companies have been mismanaged. I mean, the defined benefit pension really came out of that that world of regulation in the airlines, where price competition just wasn't on. There was an oligopoly. It was a stable system. Things could be projected. And ever since, this industry has just, it's perhaps prices have gone down. People say they have, but it's for the employees of airlines, it's just been hell, because their whole pay structure, pension, health care, all of that was sort of set up in the era of regulation. And in the competitive era, companies used these things to compete against one another. You know, in the 19th century, that was common. The railroads went into bankruptcy and then came out even stronger because they could shake off their debts.
Well, we've been talking about the impact on workers. Let's hear from one. Terry O'Rourke is joining us now. He's an avionics technician for United Airlines and a member of the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association, worked at United for 19 years. Welcome to you, Terry, and tell us a little more about what you did and what you're thinking about all of this.
Thank you, Gail. It's good to speak with you and your audience. As you said, I'm a United Airlines worker. I work at their large maintenance facility in a shop on electronic equipment that actually flies the airplane. I've been working for United for 19 years and have definitely a vested interest in what's going on with the pension plans. It was referred to earlier by another one of your guests, that there was an understanding or an unwritten understanding, a social trust between employer and employee that has essentially been torn apart. And one thing that has not been talked about is the investment management of the pension plans. I have serious questions that I've yet to research about what went on in the 90s in United Airlines pension plans. What did they invest in? Because I have a strong suspicion that United did not fund their pension plans well enough during that time, and that probably, in fact, enjoyed funding holidays. And then when the downside comes, when the dot-com bust happens, that it's the employees that suffer the problems when all the other airline problems surfaced.
Well, Terry, let me get back to your specific situation, if I may, for a minute.
Sure.
When were you planning to retire, and what are you planning to do now?
Well, it's been a goal. I'm 51 years old. It's been a goal since I was 25 to retire at age 55. I have been funding IRAs and 401ks consistently since that age. I have unfortunately gone through an experience with United Airlines, the six-year ESOP program, in which I did not, had foregone wages of about $70,000, and I netted about $1,500 out of that transaction.
This was when employees were buying the company, essentially, or buying some ownership of the company?
That's correct, and it went bust, and we were not able to sell our shares while we were still employed by the company. And, you know, therefore, you know, I couldn't afford to fund my 401k during that period of time because of the large wage cuts to buy the company. So it's been like a double or triple whammy for the employees at this point in time.
So do you have any sense of when you're going to be able to retire now?
It's like off the horizon. I mean, I can't see retiring before 60. And like I said, I've been pretty intent on doing this and putting money away as much as I could all through my working career. And it's definitely not going to be 55. And then the other thing that many people are worried about is the health insurance has deteriorated. In particular, the post-Medicare health insurance is going to subject employees of United Airlines to all the medical inflation. There's going to be a specified amount, and I know that's not the topic of your program, but that's any retiree has to consider that as one of the main issues when you retire is your health insurance.
Definitely a piece of the puzzle. Well, Terry O'Rourke, we wish you the best and hope that day will come for you sooner rather than later. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Brownlee, you know, when you hear stories like Terry's, who do you blame here? Or do you blame anybody? Is it too amorphous to be able to pin the blame on any one group or any one bad decision by the airlines or anybody else?
Yeah, there's lots of blame to go around. We probably need to talk a little bit at some point about bankruptcy laws and the role they play in all of this, which is really providing a mechanism for companies to walk away from substantial obligations. And unfortunately, the ones at the end of the bread line are the employees. And by the time they get up to the table, the bread's either gone or it's stale. And so we need to address that issue. The investment decisions that were made, I think, are an issue. The management decisions that were made, to some extent, the demands that employees may have made along the way when they thought times were good. And then we've got the government that set up the PBGC and the whole way that that has been managed, and some of the things that are on the table to try to, quote, fix the problem now, is the PBGC has gone from a surplus about 4 years ago of $10 billion to a deficit now of about $23 billion, with a lot more obligations coming along the way. So we could fill a whole page with who's to blame, but that's not going to do us any good going forward. And people are going to have to come together and figure out how to do this in a way that that absolutely doesn't destroy the workers. And I listened to someone like Terry, who has managed his his financial affairs responsibly, and he's still not going to be able to retire until 60 or more. That's really scary for the people who haven't been sort of financially responsible.
I want to bring some of our listeners into the conversation now to Lexington, Kentucky first. John's on the line. Hello, John, and welcome.
Hello. I've got a couple things here. First of all, I'm wondering why we continue to allow businesses to underfund these programs, because it seems to me like the whole concept of underfunding means that they didn't put enough money aside for it at the time. They just figured they'd pay for it down the road. But more importantly, how is this going to play into Social Security and Medicaid issue down the road? I mean, I just got to listen to this guy talk about how, you know, he's lost all these wages, wasn't able to fund his own private retirement, and now he's going to end up losing a lot of his medical benefits. Well, how does this play out down the road?
Good question, John. Let's put that one to Richard Brownlee. I'm sure you're happy to answer that one, right?
Yeah. Why don't you give me the hard ones here? A couple things on the underfunding. One is when the returns in the pension plans were quite good, they were adequately funded and sometimes overfunded. And then one of the issues is to what extent you continue funding, because companies have better things to do with their money, hopefully reinvesting in profitable businesses and expanding their business to generate more cash flow from operations, so that there's a legitimate reason why they wouldn't continue to fund when, in fact, it's substantially funded. The dilemma then becomes when we get a market crash and all of a sudden the market value goes down and then you're underfunded. So it's a tough call on companies being forced to fund when, in fact, at the time they're sufficiently funded. The other issue is when they get into financial distress, they ask for relief for not being able to fund their pension plan because they need the cash flow to go to operations. And if it goes into the pension plan, then they have to cut back their operations, which provides less cash flow to provide cash to go into the pension plan. So it's a catch-22 in many ways. And I know that's not a satisfactory answer to people who are losing their pensions, but those are two explanations as to why we see some of the underfunding that we see. On the Social Security piece, that's really a tough one, because when you look at what the proposals are, essentially it's taking basically one third of the component, the Social Security piece. People have been investing on their own, like we heard Terry talk about. The defined contribution plans now, where people would be investing their own money, you know, they're responsible for that. If we go with the proposal in Social Security, where people are going to be investing their money, if they do it well, it'll be fine. But if they don't, they've got everything tied up in their own decisions. And I'm not optimistic about people's overall ability to manage their money. On the other hand, it's not a good thing to keep it with a government when the government takes the Social Security funds and spend them. So the implications are huge, and I'm trying to think myself at my age. I probably want to take my money and run, but on the other hand, I think the long-term solution may not be that.
Well, John, thanks so much for the call. And Jack Beatty, to you, we heard Richard Brownlee refer a moment ago to this Pension Guarantee Benefit Corporation, seriously underfunded at the moment. Do the words SNL crisis spring to mind?
Well, they do. And, you know, I mean, that cost the taxpayer something like $600 billion, $1,500 for every man, woman, and child alive in 1990-something. And that was quite a hit. And, you know, when you look in the prehistory of that, it has a lot like this. I mean, deregulation was right at the heart of it. The differences between the savings and loan banks and the savings banks and commercial banks, that line was erased, and all sorts of bad loans were made. And anyway, the taxpayer wound up picking it up. Well, the question here is, is that going to happen to the taxpayer with these pensions? And if it does, through this pension benefit guarantee company, if the government bails that out, do we have a situation where people who have 401k pensions and basically have very small pensions are going to be subsidizing retired airline pilots who have very good pensions? I mean, there are going to be some questions of equity raised, it seems to me, if there is a substantial bailout.
Richard Brownlee, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm afraid that there is a reasonable probability that in fact may happen, although we're a ways from that. I think a lot's going to depend on what our politicians decide in terms of trying to shore up the financial resources that the PBGC is going to need. And two proposals that I've read about so far, where you up the per employee insurance annual payment from $19 an employee to $30. And you change essentially some of the calculations, actuarial calculations, in determining what the true pension liability is. It sounds like up the pension liability to force companies to pay even more money into the PBGC. I'm real skeptical about that's the right solution. I think the unintended consequences are serious. So if they go in the direction they're going, I'm afraid that the money coming into the to the PBGC isn't going to be adequate, and we're going to have to turn to a solution like a taxpayer bailout, and that's not an attractive solution at all. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think the politicians need to think very long and hard, because this is a serious issue, and it goes right at the heart of American business.
We're going to continue our discussion in just a minute after we take a break. We're talking this hour about a possible pension meltdown and what all of that might mean for Americans' retirement plans. Can companies afford to be generous to employees when they're competing in a global economy? Do you worry that whatever planning you do for retirement won't be enough? And do you think we'll see a bailout like the savings and loan bailout for pension plans this time? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the airline industry turning its back on retirees and what that could mean for your retirement plans. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine your company pension plan disappearing? Do you have any other plans instead? And are these plans just too big a burden for U.S. companies to bear in this newly competitive global economy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Richard Brownlee, professor at the Darden School of Business Administration at the University of Virginia, and with Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. And from Washington now, Tom Gigo joins us. He is a partner at the Groom Law Group, where he represents employers in negotiations with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. He's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Law School. Welcome to you, Tom.
Thank you, Gail. Thank you for inviting me to join you.
So give us a little sense from your point of view about how the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation works and these concerns about how seriously underfunded it is and what role it might have to play.
Right. Thank you, Gail. Yes, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or PBGC to us, its role is to insure the private pension plans in America. One of the unhappy parts of PBGC's job is to step in and close down underfunded pension plans that are in the situation faced by United's plans. And it does that for the same kinds of reasons that bank regulators like the FDIC step in to shut down failing banks. It's to protect the insurance system so that the assets that are there are allocated fairly and that there is not an increased draw on the insurance system. This is something that an extreme action that PBGC takes only in extreme situations, and it certainly is unfortunate for the stakeholders involved.
Do you see the pressure only increasing on PBGC over the years, and you know, are we looking at a meltdown at some point?
That's a good question, Gail. This is something that PBGC itself looks at very carefully. And just by way of background, it's important to note that the defined benefit pension system in this country is not something that's growing. By and large, we have a finite set of companies that already have these plans. There are not a whole lot of new entrants into the system. Each year, PBGC looks at that system, and it identifies the big plans with substantial underfunding, and it produces a measure of that underfunding. Right now, for example, the agency will estimate that there's $400 to $500 billion of total underfunding out there. But that's not the most important measure or the only measure. One of the other things that the PBGC looks at is the creditworthiness of the companies that are sponsoring these plans. The creditworthiness is the indication of whether the company is going to be able to fund its obligations to the plan. So when you look at the PBGC's studies today, you will see that they've identified roughly $90 billion of underfunding in plans sponsored by companies in that category of at-risk credit status. And you'll also see that the PBGC's list focuses on companies in first in the manufacturing industries and second in the transportation industries like airlines.
Well, where would you say then we are on the scale from worrisome to terrifying?
I'd like to offer a different answer and perhaps a more optimistic one. For most people, I don't think there is a need to panic. By and large, the nation's private pension system is working fairly well. There's over $3 trillion of assets funding these plans, which by comparison to Social Security or the government's own pension plans for its workers is pretty solidly funded, and many of these companies and most of these companies are doing a good job of keeping pace with the required contributions. The problem we have is in these industries where the underfunding is concentrated and where the company backing the pension plan is having troubles itself financially and its credit status is low. The problem exists, again, primarily because of the financial condition of these companies that are behind the plans.
All right. I want to bring in one of our listeners now who's on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. Rick is joining us. Hello, Rick.
Good evening. I just wanted to make a comment. I find it rather disconcerting that companies the size of United Airlines can claim protection under the bankruptcy laws and then do away with or severely change the pension obligations that they have and often the medical obligations that they have to retirees. Then retirees who depend on this have their lives thrown topsy-turvy and get into, let's say, a catastrophic medical claim, and they can't pay that because their benefits are gone and their income source is gone. And yet we've changed the bankruptcy laws for individuals to make it much more difficult for them to file bankruptcy and to get the same protection that we're offering to the companies. And that's all I really had to say. I'll let you guys deal with it as you would.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Richard Brownlee, maybe you want to chime in on that one first.
Well, I think Rick is right. I commented earlier that at some point we needed to address the bankruptcy laws because that's really the mechanism that the United Airlines and others are using. US Air used a couple months ago, and many others have used to be able to walk away from substantial obligations. And the fundamental problem is, one, you go back to basic accounting, assets equal liabilities plus owner's equity. And these organizations, liabilities have been growing tremendously and equity has been going down. And the only way they see they can survive is to dump a whole lot of liabilities. And when you look at what the liabilities are, you have some of it to your suppliers, but suppliers get smart and quit supplying you unless they get cash on, you know, at the time they deliver. And then you've got the lenders, and most of that's secured. And then you've got sort of the other liabilities. And here are these employees with these large pension obligations owed to them, and you go down the pecking order, and they're the easy pickings, and that's what's happening through the bankruptcy courts. I don't know what the answer is, but that's why I said earlier they're at the end of the bread line, and there's not any bread left or it's stale, and that's not a good position to be in.
Gail, you know, in the bankruptcy bill that just passed, the Democrats offered an amendment to have it cover just what Rick was talking about, medical bankruptcies. An expert said this accounts for about half of all bankruptcies. Divorce and death usually are the other reasons. And the Republicans, driven by Tom DeLay, turned it down. Nope, you're going to go medical bankrupt in this country, you're going to have to pay it off. And those bills can be really, really severe. So I think his point is really, he's just pointed to an absurdism in our situation. Individuals don't have the same rights now under bankruptcy that huge corporations do.
Adrian's on the line now from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hello, Adrian, and welcome to you.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I only have one comment. And that is, I wonder how much of a cut the Sea Eagles are taking.
Anyone know the answer to that one?
Well, let me just say that one of the other problem areas that we have in this country is that CEO pay in the United States relative to CEO pay around the world is excessive. And Let me just leave it at that. But I don't think we're going to see suffering at the top level.
All right. To Wayland, Massachusetts now. Stas is on the line. Stas, welcome to you.
Hello?
Okay. Nope, there he is. Stas, you with us?
Well, you got the wrong person. But anyhow, I'm a retired United pilot. And the way the canceling of our pension plan affects us is if you're a pilot or a person that retires at 65, the maximum payment the PBGC will pay is $45,000. The pilots are required to retire at 60. And a pilot retiring at 60 will get only in the neighborhood of $25,000 a year. And a pilot who is 70 would get almost all of his defined benefits. He would not get his non-qualified funds that are paid by the company. So,
now, did you retire some time ago, and so you are going to get your full benefits, or how does your situation work?
Well, I will get close to my defined benefits, the amount that I was getting. I will lose the non-qualified funds because they are paid by the airline as a salary expense. You know, we are limited by the government as to the amount we could get a year in pension.
And I'm sorry, you'll have to forgive us because we're limited by time, but thank you so much for being with us. Richard Brownlee, a final thought here?
Let me just say thanks for being part of this conversation. I have a feeling that if you're kind enough to invite me back, I might get a chance to return because I think this conversation about this problem is going to continue. And hopefully next time we have a conversation, things will look a little better and we'll begin to find some solutions. But thanks again for the opportunity.
Well, we appreciate your being with us. Tom Gijo, any final thoughts from you? Are you optimistic that the next time we talk about this, it'll look a little better?
Well, we sure hope so down here in Washington. There are a number of proposals on the table to fix the problem from one direction or the other. And one of the things that we have been working on is a proposal that would help the airlines make sure that they pay for their pensions in full by allowing them to, in effect, refinance their obligation over a longer term in return for not putting new liabilities on the table and at risk for the insurance system. So there are some good ideas being
Tom, we'll have to leave it there.
Washington.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us from Washington. Terry O'Rourke joined us earlier in the program, and Richard Brownlee from Charlottesville, Virginia. Thank you so much for being with us. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. And Jack Beatty, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. In just a moment, a new format named Jack, not Jack Beatty, that's changing American radio. The radio landscape in cities across the country has been transformed over the past couple of months by a new music format. It goes by names like Jack, Mike, Charlie, or Bob. It's hallmark music of all genres, ranging from 80s glam rock to Motown to the dance tracks from the 21st century. It's not completely random. Every song on the playlist has been a top 40 hit at some point during the past three decades, but it can sound pretty random when AC/DC is followed by Aretha Franklin and then John Mayer. Critics say it's a flash in the pan, but so far the ratings have been strong for stations that have adopted the format. Mike Henry is one of the founders of Jack Radio. There are now 12 Jack stations in cities from Baltimore to San Diego, and there are countless other stations across the country that are not affiliated with Jack but have adopted Jack's principles, using names like Mike or Bob instead. Tonight, Mike Henry explains the theory behind Jack Radio.
Radio, biggest revolution in 40 years. Radio, Jack FM, playing what we want. Jack FM New York, a BuzzNet Media station.
I know what boys like, I know what guys want.
The Jack FM format is a new radio format, and the major change that it represents to radio is the amount of music that it plays. For a commercial radio station, we're playing 1,500 titles or more in every market that we're in, and the average number of titles that most radio stations play are, you know, in the 300 to 400 range. So that's a dramatic departure in terms of the amount of music that's played. The other unique aspect of it on a music level is the type of music we play. It is not narrow, and it doesn't represent one style of music the way most radio formats and stations have for the last 15, 20 years. And so on Jack FM, you're going to hear everything from classic rock to top 40 to alternative, dance, Motown, everything that was a hit for the last 30, 35 years, you're going to hear on Jack FM.
Jack.
We use different styles of music to follow each other back to back to back so that you're not going to hear three of the same types of songs in the row. Whereas, you know, most stations take great care in flowing music so that it all works together, we work the opposite trait, and we try very hard to create train wrecks and to have segues that are as distinctly different as possible. And what we find is that people will say, you know, I don't like everything you play, but I can't change the station because I'm so curious as to what you're going to play next. It's one of those situations where the timing was just right. When we created the format in 2002 for Rogers Media in Vancouver, we were just trying to fix one radio station that was broken and needed a new format. And as fate would have it, during that same time period is when iPods have come to the forefront of culture. In 2002, I didn't have an iPod. I don't think I'd ever seen one. So we did not create the format based on the concept, but just because the timing was right, I guess, after we created the format, iPods did come into the forefront of culture, and so a lot of people do relate the Jack FM format to iPods, and they say it's like my iPod on shuffle. I think in retrospect, history will show that what Jack FM did more than anything on a radio historical basis was it showed that you don't have to be so narrow, you don't have to be so tight. You can let these radio stations breathe and play more music, and frankly, the listeners deserve more credit than radio has given them for their ability to digest many different types of music, not just one on one radio station.
Mike Henry is the CEO of Paragon Media Strategies in Denver, Colorado. He is one of the pioneers of the Jack Radio format. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.